Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Revelo P. Oliver's America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative, and we're going to do his section on Arnold Toynbee. This will be a little bit shorter than some of our segments, but let's dig in. Part 2, Arnold Toynbee, British historian. The most fashionable and widely publicized philosophy of history today is undoubtedly that of Arnold J. Toynbee, T-O-Y-N-B-E-E, whose massive and imposing study of history was only recently brought to completion with the publication of the 12th and final volume, Reconsiderations, Oxford University Press, New York, 1961, 740 pages. Mr. Toynbee has enjoyed a success perhaps never before attained by a writer on a subject that is necessarily complex and, in some aspects, abstruse. 30 years ago, he was virtually unknown. No one remembered a book which, although widely circulated many years before, had quickly become obsolete and had, by general consent, been completely forgotten. A few persons in England knew that a man named Toynbee was somehow connected with an Umbratil Institute of some kind, and with its even more obscure periodical. That was all. The Dual Doctrine. When the first volume of A Study of History was published in 1934, Mr. Toynbee, like Byron, awoke to find himself famous. Unlike Byron, he also found himself universally respected. Byron was kind of a loose, dissolute poet, hence not respected the way Toynbee was, a respectable historian. The learned journals reviewed his work with scrupulous attention. Periodicals of mass circulation, such as Time, quickly made his name a household word, and for a quarter of a century his fame increased with each new volume that came from the press of the world's most venerated university. The 12 volumes have sold widely. An abridgment of the first 10 volumes stood high on bestseller lists, and the Oxford Press's republication of the whole work in paperback form, now in progress, again, he's writing in the early 60s, will bring Toynbee into the hands of many thousands who previously knew him only by reputation. Again, our subtitle here is The Dual Doctrine. Mr. Toynbee, unlike other writers on the subject, was not content to formulate just one philosophy of history. He has given us, of his abundance, at least two. With the publication of Volume 1 in 1934, he embarked on the presentation of a cyclic theory of history that could fairly be described as a revision of Spengler's. So his first theory revises Spengler's cyclical theory. He adopted the Spenglerian conception of world history as the record of several different civilizations, each a discrete entity, fundamentally different from all others, and having a Weltanschauung, or conception of reality, irreconcilable with theirs. So, say there's 8, 9, 10, 11 discrete civilizations, organic, they're born, they grow, they die, each driven by different ideas. That was Spengler's conception. And he's saying that Toynbee, the British guy, is revising that theory. These diverse civilizations were similar, however, in that they all naturally passed through the same stages of growth and decline, and Mr. Toynbee, adopting the Spenglerian term, undertook to study their morphology, that is, the forms they took over time. By drastically lowering the standards for determining what constitutes a civilization, Mr. Toynbee increased the number of cultures to be compared and studied to the astonishing total of 21. But he undertook to examine each of these as an essentially closed system in conformity with the Spenglerian model, although in terms of his own conception of historical causality. Along the course thus charted, Mr. Toynbee sailed steadily enough, secundis ventis, through four volumes. In the fifth, his more attentive readers noticed an odd vacillation, as though the hand on the wheel had become unsteady, And then, at the midpoint in his voyage, the skipper suddenly threw his helm hard a port and veered away on a study of, quote, universal religions. Before long, it became apparent to his astonished passengers that he was heading back toward some notion of universal progress. He was, in fact, steering with ever-increasing excitement and exaltation toward the one world, quote-unquote, of contemporary anti-Western propaganda. The Sage of Chatham House. The first volume sufficed to establish Toynbee's reputation as a great philosopher of history, and for this there were good reasons that had nothing to do with journalistic acclaim. Toynbee's elaborate, though often muzzy, doctrine strongly appealed to his readers because it offered them an escape from the determinism of Spengler, without rejecting the striking parallels between civilizations that make Spengler's thesis so cogent. That in all these widely disparate civilizations, 8 or 9, you know, you can still find common elements of how they develop and fade. Without rejecting the striking parallels between civilizations that make Spengler's thesis so cogent, so compelling, Toynbee taught that each civilization was periodically confronted with, quote, challenges, to which it had to respond, and that the kind of response that made it determined its immediate future, and hence its ability to respond to the next. That interpretation corresponds so closely to our experience as individuals in our own lives that it seems correct, as indeed it may be. The author, as is obvious from the very first page, is a man of great erudition. He has read all the standard works on the history and culture of every nation in the world, and he has read many thousands of books besides, including monographs such as are usually only known to specialists in some small field. He has stored his mind with innumerable facts and conjectures, and his ability to draw comparisons from the whole ambit of recorded history shows that his learning is not of the pedestrian variety that depends on voluminous and systematic notes. His readers stand in awe of a man who knows so much. Mr. Toynbee's subject is comparison of the beliefs and development of different cultures, and for his purposes, it really does not matter whether the first dynasty in Babylon, for example, began its rule in 1950 BC or in 1806 BC or in some year between those limits. He treats us, however, to an appendix of 42 closely printed pages in which he examines critically the views of Sidursky, Thoreau, Dangin, Goetze, Sidney Smith, Ungnad, Albright, van der Weerden, Cornelius, Purbel, Boer, Dawson, Schubert, and others, and judiciously concludes that the correct date is probably either 1894 or 1831. This shows his concern for the acribeia, the minute precision and meticulous accuracy that the true scholar strives to attain wherever possible. True scholars care about precise accuracy. Mr. Toynbee, furthermore, bears the weight of his learning easily. Although he does not always do so, he can, on occasion, write with the urbanity and wit that so frequently mark the best British scholarship and so rarely grace the work of learned men of other nations. With those qualities, he combines an almost ostentatious modesty. He appears to a special advantage in the concluding volume of his work, where the sweet reasonableness, deference, and even humility with which he answers his critics would disarm the pen of a Zoilus or an A.E. Houseman. When one has read those pages, it seems positively wicked to say anything unkind about Arnold J. Toynbee. The author, furthermore, is at some pains to let us know that, although he is not in the least proud of it, he comes from old British stock. His Danish forefathers probably came to Lincolnshire in the time of King Canute. Although he is too polite to say so, Mr. Toynbee could look down on the descendants of more recent immigrants, such as the Normans, who did not arrive until 1066. We think of him as a representative of the stability of the English people and of their enduring traditions. To this, we must add the great prestige that comes from the finest and most thorough education that the Western world has ever been able to bestow on its youth. As he frequently reminds us with apologetic phrases, Mr. Toynbee, in the years immediately preceding the First World War, so distinguished himself in literae humaniores at Oxford that he was appointed a fellow of Balliol. It's one of the colleges of Oxford. He is, therefore, a scholar in the original and proudest sense of the English word. And although educational hucksters today recommend various kinds of cheap ersatzstoff, ersatz or replacement stuff, Mr. Toynbee necessarily appears to the modern eye as a figure illumined by the sunset glow of a great age when men could afford to cultivate the human mind and spirit for their own sake. He gives us, furthermore, some proof of his accomplishment. The poem, volume 10, page 135, which begins with a felicitous reminiscence from the chorus of Agamemnon, must be reckoned among the best Greek elegiacs written in the past few decades. They are certainly worthy of a place in a collection of modern writing in the learned tongues, such as some Oxford compositions, Oxford, 1949. If, as Mr. Toynbee implies, the verses are his, he mastered, at least for a time, a high and difficult art. But Mr. Toynbee, unfortunately, overdoes it. He doth protest too much. With his mannered self-abasement and orgulous apology, orgulous means excessively proud, he finally confesses with many a sigh, volume 12, page 590, that he, poor fellow, would have found it easier to write his 12 volumes in either Greek or Latin. That does it. We simply cannot believe him, for the same reason that we could not believe a sculptor who claimed that he found it easier to carve in marble than to model in clay. If the seven great scholars of Oxford who contributed their carefully wrought prose and verse to the composition cited above saw that page, they undoubtedly clutched at their collars and rushed for the brandy. Though impressive at first, Toynbee's ostentatiously masochistic modesty soon reminds us of Landor's line, quote, humility, a tattered cloak that pride wears when deformed. And eventually we suspect that we have all along been in the presence of an erudite and polyglot Uriah Heep. The Tangled Web. This is the next subtitle. It would be extremely difficult, and within limits of less than 300 or 400 pages, impossible, to criticize the study of history systematically and fairly. There are errors of fact, but few for which Mr. Toynbee does not or could not cite some book from which he took the statement. We should thus find ourselves arguing about his use of many hundreds of secondary sources, and we should have to consider each instance separately. We could examine such points as the claim that Alexander the Great had a, quote, vision of the, quote, unity of mankind, and we could review in 35 or 40 pages the evidence that shows that Toynbee and Sir William W. Tarn were dreaming when they saw that vision in Alexander's mind. But even if we proved our case to everyone's satisfaction, we should have dealt with a detail that is insignificant when one considers the scale of the study as a whole. If we examine Mr. Toynbee's discussions of historical causes, our objections at many points will deal not so much with what he says as with what he does not say, the alternatives that he does not consider. It is as though we were reading the first part of a detective story in which the victim dies after drinking a cocktail, but the sleuth does not think of questioning the butler. To correct the omission, however, we have to rewrite the story. If we consider Mr. Toynbee's two or more synoptic views of history, we find that his theories are stated with such involution of language, so much backtracking and proviso, so many nebulous, hazy, hints of unexplored possibilities, that it is very difficult to say, with any confidence, precisely what his philosophy of history is at any point in his narrative. To elicit a comprehensive system from his discussions, we should have to compare what he says here with what he says there, and then both with what he says in another place, And in the end, we should find ourselves weighing one view against another in an effort to determine how they may be reconciled, or which represents what Toynbee usually believes. But we need not undertake so formidable a task. Fortunately for us, Mr. Toynbee, once again, could not let well enough alone. Not content with having produced the study, he needs must favor us with a series of shorter works. And these, presented to the world as embodying the conclusions to which the sage was led by his long study and meditation, give us an opportunity to check the answers without going step by step through the involved computations from which they were presumably derived. Or to vary the figure, we need no longer examine the separate strands to see the shape of the web that Toynbee so laboriously wove. What Toynbee learned. We need not here consider Toynbee's Hellenism. Oxford, 1959. Hellenism refers to sort of the Greek culture spread after maybe the Greek states themselves declined. A quick survey of the field in which he claims the greatest competence. It is the only book in which he appears as an historian describing events rather than as a philosopher of history seeking to elicit a comprehensive theory from the events. As I pointed out in a brief review written at the time, the book contains a number of errors of fact. Some errors of sheer carelessness, such as mistaking the names of persons for the names of places, and frequent and undiscriminating confusions of conjecture with fact. It would disgrace a tyro. Tyro is a beginner or novice. But more immediate and important matters claim our attention. T-Y-R-O. So he's saying Toynbee made a lot of basic factual errors that would embarrass even a beginner. And intelligent people always like to insult each other to prove that they're more intelligent than the other intelligent fellow. They're very vain. When Mr. Toynbee's The World in the West was published in 1953, readers who respected him could not believe that he really thought that the budding civilization of Soviet Russia had been affrighted in its tender soul by the ruthless aggressiveness of Europeans and Americans. They accordingly assumed that the book was merely a journalistic tour de force designed to tickle, quote, liberal, unquote, reviewers in the proper places and so win a wider audience and better income for Mr. Toynbee. And again, he always puts liberal in quotes, almost always. Why, I'm not sure, other than the general use of that is to suggest they're not really liberal, but I'm not quite sure what he's contrasting them with, maybe classical liberals, since they're socialist liberals even by the time he's writing. Few who made that charitable assumption in 1953 knew that Mr. Toynbee had, for the past 30 years, been a senior member of the salaried staff of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, sort of like our Council on Foreign Relations, globalists, and that Mrs. Toynbee had been on the same payroll for an even longer time. In fact, according to the information that Mr. Toynbee has volunteered, Volume 10, page 241, the study was written, quote, under the auspices of the Royal Institute, which paid for much, if not all, of the time that was devoted to its composition. That is worth noting, for the Royal Institute of International Affairs is the British counterpart of our Tenebrous, T-E-N-E-B-R-O-U-S, and recently exposed Council on Foreign Relations, having been established by the same international clique at the same time for the same purpose. C.F. Dan Smoot, The Invisible Government. That's one of those little paperbacks you used to see floating around. None Dare Call It Conspiracy is another of that type. Now, what does tenebrous mean? It means dark, shadowy, or obscure. Murky. Another vocabulary word. Few who read Mr. Toynbee's silly little book also read an important work by Paul W. Schaefer, S-H-A-F-E-R, and John Howland Snow, The Turning of the Tides, The Longhouse, New Canaan, Connecticut, 1953, New Edition, 1962. I'm reading you always the parentheticals about the publishing in case you wanted to look it up, which is why he included it. They could have learned from that book that the Rockefeller Foundation, which is virtually a subsidiary of the Council on Foreign Relations, see Dan Smoot, OpSite, pages 161 to 168, in The Invisible Government, had, according to its annual reports, subsidized Mr. Toynbee's work to the extent of $200,000 in 1946 and of $50,625 in 1947. An examination of later reports would probably show that the Rockefeller Foundation did not abate its eagerness to help Mr. Toynbee study history. And the Foundation's check-writing affection for Mr. Toynbee is particularly significant when we note that, according to Messrs. Schaefer and Snow, pages 116F, the Foundation simultaneously subsidized a publication designed to counteract, quote, prejudice in favor of the continued existence of the United States, a project also described by Mr. Smoot, OpSite, page 164F, who observes that its express purpose, thinly veiled in a little double talk, was so to falsify the historical record that Americans would go on believing the sleazy lies fabricated by the Roosevelt gang and its criminal allies before and during the Second World War. So the globalists are trying to destroy the conception that there's some value in individual nations, particularly the U.S., in order to serve their one-world goals. And again, this is he's writing in the 60s. Since those facts were generally unknown, many readers continued to respect Mr. Toynbee until he produced a combined travel book and supplement to the study entitled East to West, Oxford Press, 1959. Even readers who had been thus far dazzled by Mr. Toynbee's erudition and affectations had to reconsider after perusing that screed. In the study, the author had, with fair consistency, appeared in the role of an historian engaged in expounding the meaning of ancient and recent events, and his admirers could always point out that it was not his fault, any more than it was Spengler's, if his prognosis of our future seemed dismal to us. But in East to West, Mr. Toynbee injudiciously spoke in propria persona, in his own voice. Propria, his own, or proprietary, right, related. And thus disclosed what was either a strange tropism. Tropism is a tendency to grow towards something. A tendency of his own mind, or a conscious intent to impose on his readers. Toynbee, for example, visited Australia. His comments show that he perceived and appreciated the many admirable qualities of the Australians, and especially of those who live in the regions that correspond to the American frontier of a century ago. I guess he means the outback by that. Most of Australia is in a thin coastal strip on the east side. But he speaks of them with a melancholy resignation with which we speak of a friend who is suffering from an incurable and fatal disease. The pullulent, or teeming, mass of barbarians commanded by Sukarno, that's up in Indonesia, wants Australia, so as a matter of course, the Australians will have to be butchered and liquidated to make way for that avid and feral horde. So again, internationalism. Australia must become Asian. All white nations must be swamped, the globalist command. So far as we can tell, it never occurred to Mr. Toynbee that the British or Americans could or should help America, Australia resist the coming invasion, or at least desist from financing Sukarno and supplying him with the weapons that he and his savages will use to exterminate the Australians. So again, remember that this is right before we have a change in the case of Australia, the white Australian policy that kept Australia white. So the globalists are fomenting this crap in the middle decades of the 20th century, leading to the change in policies. And not just Jews. Toynbee's not a Jew. And the Royal Council is there may be Jews on it, but it's ethnic British as well. Now, had Toynbee considered that possibility and come to the conclusion that cowards or degenerates or traitors in London and Washington would permit or contrive massacre of the Australians, we should have to regard him as either a congenital pessimist or an observer who shrewdly foresaw in 1958 the policies Macmillan and Kennedy are obviously and almost admittedly pursuing in 1963. But there is no slightest hint that such a consideration ever presented itself to the Toynbean intellect, which evidently just found it unthinkable that white men and Occidental civilization should not be abolished wherever and whenever a horde of prolific bipeds from the jungle lands covets lands that a generation of Western men, by their sweat and blood, redeemed from wilderness and desert. That was but one of many indications. That was but one of many indications that there were short circuits in the high-voltage mind. In Burma, Mr. Toynbee was delighted to find that at any moment, quote, a mob of Buddhist monks may suddenly fling off the yellow toga and start fighting with staves, swords, and revolvers, or even hand grenades. If I remember correctly, every military man who has reported on guerrilla operations in Southeast Asia has remarked that the garb of Buddhist mendicants, beggars, is the favorite disguise of communist agents. And many defectors from the communist conspiracy, most recently Alexander Kazhnachev in Inside a Soviet Embassy, which we reviewed last November, have made it clear that the international criminals have penetrated Buddhism as deeply as they have penetrated the National Council of Churches in the United States. Now, if Mr. Toynbee, perhaps out of consideration for the Rockefeller Foundation, which was, of course, standing by with its checkbook and financing his globetrotting, had simply clapped his hands over his eyes and ears with a resolve to see no communists and hear no communists, whatever he might think, we could understand and even forgive him. But he was enraptured by what he saw. He perfervidly assured us that the monks' hijinks with revolvers and hand grenades were evidence of, quote, the spiritual light that is radiating from Burman minds, and that these effulgent minds were determined, quote, to give something precious to the world. The easiest explanation was that Mr. Toynbee, like many men who have no religion and no capacity for religious faith, had inflated himself with a vaporous and vapid religiosity. And although it is an historian's wearisome task to catalog and distinguish the thousand varieties of Gnostic gibberish that the Goethe of the Near East have been peddling for millennia, Mr. Toynbee, it seemed, could not get enough of the mystical mishmash. He made a pilgrimage to see the Druze, a tribe of about 100,000 squalid and ignorant fanatics in the mountains of Lebanon and Syria. They called themselves the Muwahideen, Unitarians, because they worship the one true God, who was Hakim Biamrillahi, a crazy Fatimite caliph, now chiefly remembered because of his hatred of Christianity, which led him to destroy the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem in 1010, and thus to arouse in Europe the indignation that found expression in the Crusades. Although the Druze believe in the propriety of professing any religion that will help them take advantage of the foreign devils, it is known that their creed is a grotesque compound of some Judaism, several Muslim heresies, a doctrine of reincarnation borrowed from India, some primitive magic, and a spice of devil worship taken from the Yazidis. After poking around in this religious refuse, Mr. Toynbee opined that it may contain, quote, the pearl of great price for which a frustrated world is seeking, and thus represent the future religion of the whole world. There were many similar passages. No attentive reader could escape the painful conclusion that the most important lesson to be learned about Mr. Toynbee's ponderous study of history was that Mr. Toynbee had learned nothing from the study of history. Learning about Toynbee. The earlier books, though very significant, left us unprepared for Mr. Toynbee's latest, America and the World Revolution, Oxford University Press, New York, 231 pages. This brings us to the end of the story, and much that was obscure has now become clear. For one thing, we learn at last exactly how Mr. Toynbee, as a superhistorian, evaluates historical sources. He repeatedly quotes as, quote, authoritative, the blatant propaganda about Latin America manufactured by the notorious Herbert I. Matthews, who lied so brazenly on behalf of his pal Fidel Castro that even the New York Times felt obliged to suspend him from its staff. So a sort of modern Walter Duranty lied about the Soviet Union. Herbert Matthews lied about Cuba in the pages of the New York Times. The former won a Pulitzer. The latter apparently lied so egregiously that he's saying he was even suspended. An event as noteworthy as the expulsion of a man for creating an unpleasant odor in a glue factory. How stupendously dishonest and bad you have to be suspended from a place that lies as a matter of business, like the New York Times. Other authorities on eternal truth invoked by our macrocephalic historian are Adlai Stevenson, Kennedy's speechwriters, and the like. It is not remarkable that Mr. Toynbee once again rebukes the crass and crude Americans, who are all so rich and corrupted by their wealth that they want to own whatever property their masters in Washington permit them temporarily to retain. We bores have long known that if only we were properly irradiated with, quote, spiritual light, unquote, we would be ashamed of ourselves for wanting to keep some part of the fruit of our labor when the world is full of cannibals, pygmies, and other superior beings who want to be given Lincoln Continentals, gold-plated beds, and similar civil rights. What is noteworthy is that the book at last discloses the full perspective of world history as seen by Mr. Toynbee, and we can now see to the end of the vista. For the philosopher explains our own history to us and exhorts us to be true to the ideals of our great forefathers. And here, for your information, is our history in a nutshell. As we all know, it was at Concord Bridge that the embattled proletarians fired, quote, the shot heard round the world. And the sound of that shot has been rolling around the world ever since. It inspired the exhilarating massacre known as the French Revolution, and then it went on rolling round and round until it inspired the true successors of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, Lenin and Trotsky, to raise hell in Russia. And the sound went on rolling until it roused true American ideals in the noble breast of Mao Zedong in China. And now the sound has come rolling back to us, for it has exalted the heart of the new George Washington, who made Cuba a base for Soviet missiles, submarines, and troops. Mr. Toynbee admits that there are a few minor details that disturb the beautiful simplicity of that historical panorama. There were some Americans, such as John Adams, who were so bigoted that they disapproved of the French Revolution. That, I know, is hard to understand. But suppose that the odor of that much blood would suffice to set any true liberal slavering for social reform. Adams, Mr. Toynbee concedes, would have disapproved of even the Bolshevik takeover of Russia. And even today there are Americans so benighted that they disapprove of Castro, despite the fact that, as Mr. Toynbee wistfully remarks, Fidel is really a rather beautiful name if American lips could pronounce it dispassionately. As a fair-minded man, Mr. Toynbee grants that even Bolsheviks have some shortcomings, although he does not bring up the question. I feel certain he would not deny that Khrushchev, when he murdered millions of people in the Ukraine and elsewhere, was guilty of a certain gaucherie, was in fact downright rude. I am sure Mr. Toynbee would not deny it, because he does admit, reluctantly, that the, quote, generous-minded vein in communism, unquote, is marred by something much worse, a tendency toward, quote, nationalism. But even that is no excuse for failing to see that communism, quote, does stand in principle for winning social justice for the great majority of mankind, unquote. If our gross and earthbound minds had not become insensitive to spiritual light, we piggish Americans would see all this, and we would not be troubled by a bit of indecorum with machine guns now and then. It is true, however, that there is some friction between the United States and the Soviet. You see, we have let the Bolsheviks get ahead of us and take over, quote, America's historic role as the revolutionary leader of the depressed majority of mankind. But there is still hope for us, provided we heed the voice of history. We can take the lead again by just becoming more communist than the Soviet. It's as simple as all that. Mr. Toynbee might have told us more about the spiritual aspects of killing and looting had he not been so distracted. But he remembered the atomic bomb, and so, of course, he started yammering. Quote, "If we are to avoid mass suicide, we must have our world state quickly," he cries. But he is more frank than most of the one-worlders who plant boob bait on behalf of the United Nations. Mr. Toynbee says that, quote, "parliamentary institutions just won't work in one world. There isn't time. So, if we do not want to be frizzled with sizzling neutrons, quote, we have to start building a world state now on the best design practicable at the moment." Unquote. Why say more? Even earthbound minds may be able to figure out that the only alternative to parliamentary institutions is a dictatorship. And the world's most experienced and successful technician is fortunately available for the job. You will find him in his office in the Kremlin. Unless, by the time this appears in print, he is back in the United States with his arm around an elected president and his eye on us. Khrushchev visited the U.S. in the 50s. The price of the head. And so, after 30 years of coy cavorting, Mr. Toynbee has brought his Dance of Ishtar to a climax, and the last of the seven veils has fallen. What is disclosed will, I trust, charm no one. As we reach toward the end here in another page. It is now obvious that, one, to absorb Mr. Toynbee's wisdom, you need not trouble your head about what happened in history. Just toss the 12 volumes of the study in the wastebasket and go around to the nearest church in which a crypto-communist is administering his social gospel to the drowsy members of his Sunday morning club. Or, if you prefer a little less hypocrisy, read The Worker or The People's World communist organs. Two, the vistas of American history disclosed in Mr. Toynbee's latest book are, as we can now see in retrospect, the port towards which he has been steering us on a calculated course ever since he executed the hard aport maneuver midway in his study of history. To be sure, if we go back to Volume 1, we find no hint of his ultimate destination. I cannot help reflecting, however, that if Mr. Toynbee had not begun as a scholar engaged in a revision of Spengler, he would never have been taken seriously as a philosopher of history, so he used Spengler's fame to promote goals that Spengler wouldn't approve of, all funded by Rockefeller and the Royal Council. Had he begun as an irradiator of his brand of quote-unquote spiritual light, his audience would have been limited to the little coteries of would-be Illuminati who frequent, quote, temples of understanding and play religious charades. It is a rule of our basically kind and generous society that a man's early lapses must be ignored and unmentioned if he seems to be, quote, going straight. But a recidivist is another matter. I deem it proper, therefore, to point out that Mr. Toynbee began his public career as an intellectual prostitute. According to H.C. Peterson, Propaganda for War, Norman, Oklahoma, 1939, Toynbee was a member of the original staff of Lord Bryce's famous lie factory, lied about German atrocities in World War I, and served in the division that specialized in duping Americans. It was in this capacity that he produced his first widely circulated book, The German Terror in France, an historical record, by Arnold J. Toynbee, late fellow of Balliol College, Oxford, published in New York in 1917. Our great historian's, quote, historical record, unquote, was a tissue of malodorous mendacity couched in the language of scholarship. It was, in the words of S.L. Mach, quote, especially crass and unreliable propaganda, close quote. Belongs with a famous photograph of loaded coal cars on railway sidings outside a German foundry, which, when Lloyd Bryce's experts got through with it, showed cars loaded with dead soldiers outside a soap factory. Again, that's propaganda in World War I, created by this world-famous British historical expert. This is his real origin. He's a liar. He's a propagandist masquerading as a historian. It was a job done by an expert to deceive the people whom his employers wished to manipulate. With that accomplishment to his credit, Mr. Toynbee became the highest-ranking employee of the British half of the organization that operates in our country as the Council on Foreign Relations. CFR, big bugaboo of the anti-communist. In this capacity, he was, by his own admission, paid to work on his study of history, and there are rumors that he was provided with a staff of busy bees to collect erudition for him. He received munificent subventions from various subsidiaries and affiliates of our Council on Foreign Relations, and I venture to suggest that in the 45 years since 1917, the aging leopard did not change a single spot. So he's still a liar and a propaganda master. And that ends the section on Arnold Toynbee. A fake, a propagandist, anti-white, and a well-paid, well-remunerated globalist. Thanks for being with me today. Again, you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. And I'll be back with you again real soon for more from Revelo Oliver.